This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There's a school of thought that regards sports as pure escape, an entertainment refuge for people who are either tired of or have no interest in politics or social issues. In a book entitled What's My Name, Fool?, Dave Zirin argues the contrary. He says he loves sports, but he also loves finding in our games springboards for his opinions about how those games are corrupted, how the men who own the teams gouge the public, and how the players themselves are used or use us. Zirin appeared on our show last summer. Our conversation started with the observation that few countries play the national anthem before sporting events, which then led to the discussion of the close relationship between sports and nationalism in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the national anthem. It's having scantily clad women tell us when and when not to cheer. It's calling our national champions world champions. I mean, you go to other parts of the world and they do look at our sport and culture more than a little quizzically. But when you're talking about nationalism, I mean, that really goes back to the roots of when sports took off as kind of an organized pastime in the United States. I mean, there's always been sports in the United States, from Native Americans before Europeans even got here, to games played by working people in urban centers, to slaves on plantations. There's always been sports, competition. But when it was first sort of segmented off and turned into something that was separated from people's day-to-day lives in terms of leagues and a sports page, it was tied, even from those early days, into something that had to do with instilling what was called the American character, or preparing people for the American century. Like, if you look at some of the early philosophizers of organized sports, philosophers, I should say, that being a word, you look at people like Teddy Roosevelt, or if you look at some of the financial backers of it, like J.P. Morgan, I mean, it was very conscious with them that it wasn't just, hey, it would be really fun to get some bats and some balls and go out and play some games. No, it was very conscious, like, this is how we will harden up our men of leisure.
And numbers of leaders said this is the way to prepare young men for war.
Yes, and that's an exact quote by a former five-star general people might have heard of named Dwight David Eisenhower. That's what he said. It is about preparing young men for war. And I think that there's always been that aspect to sports, because I think sports in whatever culture you're talking about, Native American, the serfs, you know, in Russia, you know, or this society here, it's always been a reflection of that society. And certainly, you know, the U.S. has engaged in, you know, a couple of wars over the last 100 years, and I think the sporting culture definitely reflects that.
Some of the sports figures whom you identify as representative of resistance do not maintain that distinction over time. Talk a little bit about the various ways in which the country's relationship with Muhammad Ali has changed over the years.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it starts by understanding how Muhammad Ali's changed his own stance towards the country, if you want to do the full arc of it, and then how the country then reacted to him. I mean, Muhammad Ali at age 17 made the Olympic team. At age 18, he won an Olympic gold medal in Rome in 1960. And when he returned to the States, it's amazing what he said. He came back and went up to the microphone and said, "To make America the greatest is my goal. So I beat a Russian and I beat a Pole. And for the USA, I won the medal of gold. And the Greeks said, you're better than the Cassius of old." So back then, you know, he's like, you know, basically the Gorgeous George of boxing, you know. And a few years later, this will be a guy who'd be saying, "To hell with America. You can keep the white man's money. You know, this is one man you couldn't get." And so you can't understand that transformation without understanding the 1960s and the black freedom struggle and the anti-war movement and how that shaped Ali, and then how Ali in turn then shaped those movements themselves. And that's one of the things that was such a thrill to uncover with the book, is that level of interaction, which you don't really hear about in Sports Century or, you know, ESPN Presents Muhammad Ali, you know, like that level of radical edge to his life and to his politics over the course of the 1960s. And it's really quite remarkable. Now, mainstream culture at the time, you know, the media and whatnot, they absolutely despised Ali. I mean, first for changing his name, then thumbing his nose at the armed forces. But at the same time, you had a whole generation of young activists, like on college campuses, in the U.S. South, registering black voters, that were just positively electrified by this. So you had this Ali who symbolized the split in the country at the time. And whether you called him Clay or Ali, it said everything about you in terms of what side you were on in the struggles of the day.
One of the activists whom you celebrate in your book is Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, a former world champion light heavyweight who's been trying to establish a union for boxers that would provide them with medical care and pensions. What are the chances that he will succeed?
That's a terrific question, because on the one hand, boxing is one of the most utterly corrupt, decentralized, scurrilous businesses, not only sports, but businesses in the country. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think why it's hard to imagine an Ali today is back when Ali was around, boxing was in some respects the number one sport in the United States. Yet today, it's almost a carnival sideshow, given its just utter disorganization and corruption. But at the same time, where are boxing's absolute centers of power still are Las Vegas and Atlantic City, two very strong union strongholds. And Eddie Mustafa Muhammad has said, if we don't get what we're demanding for, you're going to see some boxers sit down like right in the Bellagio lounge and see what happens then. And that's an amazing thing, because I think Don King would start ponying up the dough mighty quick if Arturo Gatti decided to have a seat on top of one of the slot machines in the Bellagio.
All right. From your point of view, who are the most villainous characters in the current sports scene?
I mean, as far as people today, I mean, I would hate to say, because I wouldn't want to express my own regional bias, but certainly I have to say I think the motley crew of owners in the National Football League and their ability to really exploit the death of Pat Tillman was something that, to me, is something I can't even look at comically. I mean, just something that I thought was above and beyond the pale.
Speaking of regions, you're not a great fan of the name of the National Football League team in your region, I gather.
Yeah, and that is one of my less popular local stances, I got to tell you. Not a fan of the name Washington Redskins. Want to see the name changed. Even at the newspaper I work at, the Prince George's Post, we held a contest to change the name, which, you know, earned me some nicknames that I can't really say over the air.
Well, give me some because... that you can, because that's a potentially interesting contest.
Sure. No, it was. I'll tell you the good ones then. I mean, because, I mean, I think the Redskins is a name that belongs in the dustbin of history, along with the burning of witches. I think it's just insane that there's a pro football team with this name, and it was named by a segregationist named George Preston Marshall as a way to market the team to the South. This is all historical fact. And so, you know, in Prince George's County where I work, it's 70%, 80% African American. So I put out there, what do we want to name the team that actually reflects our area? Because unless we want gutter racism to reflect our area. And some of the answers we got were great. Like one was the Washington Dukes, after one of our favorite native son, Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
Another was actually the Washington Gays, after another favorite native son, Marvin Gaye. But I think, I'm serious. But I was saying that I don't quite know.
No controversy
know if
there.
Yeah, I don't know if we're quite there yet. I'll settle for going for Dukes, you know. The Washington Gays might be a little beyond where the collective sports consciousness is here locally. And then the one that I really liked the most at the end of the day was the Washington Snyders. Named after Dan Snyder, the owner of the team. I mean, it was done a little bit sarcastically, tongue-in-cheek, because people joked about what the mascot could look like a pudgy, obnoxious, surly gentleman who could look at everybody and go, "What are you looking at?" You know, and then charge people $10 for breathing his air. Love the mascot idea, but the name isn't too catchy.
Your writing suggests that you admire Barry Bonds enormously. Why is that?
My admiration for Barry Bonds, I mean, it starts, honestly, it's got like two prongs in some respect that exist apart from each other. One is I feel like he is the only baseball player in my lifetime, with the exception of maybe Dwight Gooden in his rookie year, who I feel like, I mean, actually stands above the game of baseball in terms of his skills. I mean, baseball is an almost impossible sport to dominate on an individual basis because of the nature of the game. And Barry Bonds dominates the sport.
You write that, quote, "By speaking out for the political soul of the games we love, we begin to compete with the yawning hypocrisy of the pro leagues." What sort of hypocrisy do you have in mind when you say that?
The yawning hypocrisy of the pro leagues. I mean, to me, the hypocrisy of the pro leagues has to do with, I'll give you just some examples, like the way that a lot of the like NFL and hockey in particular, the video games that the leagues market, trade on some like absolutely repellent violence. But at the same time, it's like, and also they do all the raunchy touchdown dances. And this is like the majority of young sports fans, they all play these games. Another is, I think, the issue of sexism is just a horrible hypocrisy in sports where there's, you know, I mean, certainly there's talk about, like, with the WNBA and women's soccer, this idea of promoting women's sports. But at the same time, it's like you've got the Coors Light twins and, you know, the cheerleaders and teams like just market sexism relentlessly to sell their games. And you know, it piles on itself and piles on itself to the point where I know a lot, and certainly the number one area is the area of commercialization in sports and the idea that you can't go 5 seconds in a stadium without feeling like someone's either selling you something, you're looking at an ad, and it can become just overbearing. And I mentioned Daniel Snyder before, owner of the Washington Redskins. I mean, you can't get free parking near the stadium anymore. You actually have to buy a Redskins credit card to get quote-unquote discounts on merchandise when actually all he did was raise the prices on everything else. I mean, so it really is, I mean, to a lot of people, it's become this point of where people are so alienated from these games that they love. And that is, I don't like. And a lot of times, sometimes I've been called like sort of like a radical sports writer or whatever. But I honestly feel like that I'm a traditionalist and Daniel Snyder is the radical because I want sports a la carte, you know? That's what I want. I grew up playing sports. I want to be able to go to the game and just enjoy it. But the reason why I feel like I even had to write a book about the radical tradition in sports was because sports, like the other side of it, the right-wing politics, reactionary politics, commercialism, are so relentlessly hustled through sports that it demands a response.
Dave Zirin writes a column called The Edge of Sports for the Prince George's Post and comments on sports for So What Else Is News on Air America. His book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, is published by Haymarket Books. He spoke with me from NPR in Washington. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's my privilege.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Coming up on Only a Game, the exceptionally accessible highest point in Rhode Island. But first, Hurricane Rita's landfall on the Louisiana coastline preempted our September 24th, 2005 show. Of course, we understood why, and it gave us a chance to have some fun with a 3-minute mini-recap the following week. Still, we felt that one story in particular got shortchanged, which is ironic, since there's nothing short at all about Karen Givens' 12-minute piece on becoming an outdoors woman. But out of all the stories that were preempted by hurricanes in the past year, this one was the best by far. So now we present Becoming an Outdoors Woman.
My Girl Scout troop took excursions to the mall. I have never gone backpacking, caught a fish, or camped more than a few hundred yards from a shower. That's why I was so pleased to be introduced to New Hampshire's Becoming an Outdoors Woman program from the front seat of a golf cart.
We're heading over to the Rocky Walls side of camp now. We came from the Deep Haven.
Laura Ryder helps more than 100 people a year become outdoors women. She makes the transition as easy as possible at the Rocky Wall Deep Haven camp on Squam Lake. Tucked away in the woods, the cabins look deceptively rustic, but they're equipped with electric lights, showers, and wireless internet.
Pretty much got everybody registered at this point. Now they're all wandering around lost.
They look kind of happy lost.
They are though. Happy lost. This is just like camp. You know, when they went to his kids and you know, they're psyched.
Ryder works for the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department, which co-sponsors this program. BOW workshops began in the early 90s after a study at the University of Wisconsin showed there was a high level of interest among women in outdoor activities like hunting and fishing, but they weren't participating. Now, more than 20,000 women a year attend BOW workshops in 43 states and 6 Canadian provinces. Ryder says the program is making a difference.
The more women get together, the more they network together, the more they see that they're not alone. It builds their confidence. They get to go out, really enjoy these things. And we want them to experience things like hunting and fishing, too. because they're a lot of fun. And again, it's not something that women in particular were ever sort of initiated into. And it's a very mysterious thing.
The idea is to remove some of the mystery with help from volunteer instructors who teach everything from archery to wilderness backpacking. Almost all of the classes are aimed at newbies, but the women are expected to roll up their sleeves and try everything they've been taught. That bit of news makes me hope that I don't actually catch anything on Sunday morning's fishing excursion.
I have high confidence that there are going to be fish caught.
Will I have to touch
in that
one
class?
Of the fish
yes,
caught?
You most definitely will. And take the hook out and release it.
I've been on lots of fishing trips with my dad, but I never had to touch a fish.
But this is it. It's your chance, your opportunity to step forward without someone else having to take it over for you. And you'll find that all this time you worried about it. And you didn't have to.
As the women gather for their first meal, it's easy to see that some are considerably more outdoorsy than others. Lori is wearing a pink shirt and designer sunglasses, though she assures me that she'll have hair on her legs before the weekend is through. At the same table, Mary is looking considerably more at home in a waffle weave shirt and hiking boots.
This is the best place on earth.
Have you been here before?
Once before, yes.
Yeah.
It's like deer camp for chicks. You know, guys grow up and they have their dads take them out and kill that first deer and eat the heart or whatever it is they do.
Surely an outdoors woman like Mary learned a thing or two in her Girl Scout experience. Surely she couldn't have been spending her time learning to cook and sewing badges onto her sash.
I did that. I made it all the way to cadets. And then I wondered, how come we're not doing the same thing Boy Scouts are doing? Because I thought what they were doing was a lot more fun. But we had to sew and learn homemaking. Yeah, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to run a vacuum cleaner.
Mary isn't the only seasoned outdoors woman trying to improve her skills at BOW. But there are also folks like Lucy Levine, who looks up from her salad to declare that she's in culture shock. Levine's a professional from L.A., and she looks the part. Her hair is neatly pulled back. Her makeup is flawless. She's not an outdoors woman, but she's looking to reconnect with the outdoors, and she signed up for classes that should help.
Basic camping skills, outdoor cooking, introduction to canoeing, and wilderness backpacking. I thought I'd start with something simple.
I noticed, you know, field dressing large game, not on the list.
No, when the application came out, it said draw a line through what you would not be ready for, and I didn't think I was ready for that.
So we take the knife and I just do this. I just punch them in. Hear the bone?
Yeah.
At Al Brook Hunter Education Center, a 15-minute drive from camp, David Buchanan and 9 eager campers have dragged a deer, the victim of a car accident, onto a blue tarp and gathered around. At first, I can't even bring myself to look. But I have to admit, Buchanan makes field dressing large game seem pretty simple.
Now, what Mary would do is she would move to this side and then turn her blade around. Hook it in the skin, and it opens like what? A zipper. Shall we let her try? Shall we just watch her?
Mary is the former Girl Scout I met earlier, and she seems thrilled with a full deer camp experience.
Just want to just, I don't know, anyone with me over there wants to feel it? Feel that?
Yep.
Every time Buchanan asks if the class would like to feel, half a dozen eager hands reach out. Despite repeated offers, nobody wants to wear gloves. It's a good thing no unsuspecting camper can accidentally stumble onto this scene. Not all BOW participants are interested in hunting, and the program offers plenty of classes about ecosystems, plants, and conservation. But Laura Ryder says interesting everyone in the same activities is not the point.
They talk to one another. People who don't take on hunting and fishing start to realize that people who do hunt and fish aren't evil, you know, and so the different user groups can interact here and be positive about it.
My name's I'm a hiker, and this is Yvonne Fischelot. Thank you all for joining us.
By Saturday night, I've recovered from my field dressing experience in time to enjoy one of the highlights of New Hampshire's BOW weekend, the fashion show presented as an episode of What Not to Wear.
So he sent us pictures of Julie in the field. She didn't know that he was taking these pictures. I mean, look at those sandals. What is she thinking?
As the instructors pose on stage in semi-ridiculous outfits, Sharon Stark Giraldi looks on the proceedings with a certain amount of sentimentality. Today, Giraldi is New Hampshire's longest-serving female fish and game commissioner. But that never would have happened, she says, if she hadn't attended New Hampshire's first BOW weekend 11 years ago.
I took Map and Compass, my favorite class, and no matter how many times my husband had tried to teach me how to read a compass, it wasn't working.
Giraldi says she's come a long way on her path to becoming an outdoors woman. Instead of sending her husband off to deer camp, she recently invited him along on one of her hunting trips. She says she finds her best opportunities for family time in the outdoors.
I have nothing against team sports, but if my son's playing football, my husband and I may be sitting on the bench, but are we doing a family activity? If the three of us go fishing together, we're all together. And I think we've lost sight of how valuable that time together is.
The mist forms swirling patterns above Squam Lake as we set out in search of fish early Sunday morning. I'm joined by eight other women, many of whom have never been fishing. Our guides are Mark Beauchesne, outdoor education coordinator for New Hampshire Fish and Game, and Kurt Golder, a local fishing guide. From the start, they make it look easy.
We can just drop it, open the bail, let it sink right to the bottom, and notice the little loops coming off the spool. If we're straight up and down, when they stop, we've hit bottom.
It takes less than half a minute for Beauchesne to explain the fishing technique we'll be using, which is longer than it takes to get his first nibble.
Bad things are happening, Kurt.
Yeah, I see it.
And I'm getting this guy out of here. Cause...
Oh.
Holy cow!
That was a stunt fish, right?
For most of us, landing a fish is a good deal more complicated. First, we have to bait our hooks with a 3-inch piece of night crawler, which turns out to be a nightmare for third-time camper, first-time fisher, Deborah Belcher.
Oh, God. I gotta do it.
As I feel the telltale bobbing on the end of my pole, I hope that my first catch will be less disgusting than my first worm. After no struggle whatsoever, I reel in a tiny red-breasted sunfish, and Kurt's on hand to snap that all-important photo.
Put your thumb in it, or your index finger, in the mouth.
In the mouth?
Yep.
Isn't it going to bite me?
There you go. Hold it.
I do not feel teeth. The fish is not slimy. Once I'm holding it correctly, it seems pretty calm and comfortable. In fact, I'm not really sure what I had been worried about all these years.
Now just place it into the water.
Bye, fishy.
For the next few hours, we catch and release more sunfish, smallmouth bass, and even a fish called a pumpkin seed. None of our fish are big enough to keep, had we been trying to keep them, except the one that got away.
Oh,
nice. There you go. That's a fish.
That is a
good size fish.
We return to camp just in time to cross paths with Lucy Levine, the career woman I met earlier. Surrounded by her newfound friends, Levine smiles and says she'd come back in a New York minute.
I was an executive. You know, as of the end of June, I was in charge of 495 elementary schools, and I had 600 people directly under me, and the concern of 710,000 students, and I was so focused in this executive position and decision-making and so full of stress. For me to come out here and do this was so wonderful. I mean, just even looking at the stars at night, which you never see in L.A., I mean, it was wonderful. It puts a whole new perspective on my life. I would wish this weekend wasn't ending.
Levine and the rest of this year's campers might not find it easy to come back. The program has a long waiting list as the New Hampshire Fish and Game saves most of the available spaces for first-timers interested in becoming outdoors women. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Holderness, New Hampshire.
Bubba had a dream, Bubba had a wish, to find himself a woman that loved the fish. One day at the tackle shop, his dream came true, and now for everyone he catches, she catches too. Hey, Bubba, she fishes better than you.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Hey, Bubba, did you hear what she said, Bubba? She fishes better than you. She fishes better than you. She fishes better than you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Over the last 15 years or so, media mavens have tuned in the Super Bowl just to see the world premieres of cutting-edge commercials produced by the country's elite ad agencies. Only a Game reveres the Super Bowl and all of its traditions, and so now we bring you this sneak preview of two television ads which should have the country buzzing.
You can't see them. You can't smell them. You can't find them. Until they explode. Exploding Imp, the 3D interactive video game from Imptronic Multimedia. Because when the imps surround you, and sooner or later they will, you have to do something.
Batteries and plastic explosives not included. Not legal in Wyoming or New Jersey.
Did you see that? Those imps really detonated. That was cool. Super even.
But wait, there's more.
More?
For the athlete in your house who's not getting bigger and better, faster and faster...
That would be me!
It's Sally's Silly Steroid Sticker!
Let me try that!
Just put the patch on any muscle you want to build...
I'll put one on each leg and run like Ben Johnson!
Just remember to remove the stickers 2 weeks before the competition. You don't want to be caught by mean old Mr. Drug Tester.
Hey, these
were great.
Offer not valid in Alaska.
You talking to me? Who plays bleeping football in Alaska?
Sally's Silly Steroid Sticker. Performance in a patch, now in a range of pastels.
Give me a dozen more in pink.
There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
Coming up on Only a Game, strikes, spares, and Raelians. But first, journal entry, Monday, September 6th, 2005. A day for climbing, and so, from a break in the woods in Foster, Rhode Island, I undertook the ascent of Gerimuth Hill to the highest point in the Ocean State. At a turn in the trail, I encountered two other intrepid climbers, Kathy and Ray Bissett. In Ray, I noted what seemed to be the troubling first stages of exhaustion.
Yeah, I was looking for a pub or something, but I don't see one here, no.
I did my best to keep his spirits up.
Well, get ready, because this is the summit coming up here.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yep, if you go over and stand on this rock, you will in fact have summited. And I think the record should show that you did this in sandals.
Right, right.
Both of you did this in sandals. All right, stay there. I got to get a picture.
What a beautiful day.
It was, in fact, a beautiful day as we all stood on the rock at the highest point in Rhode Island, the culmination of a good 3.5-minute walk. Stoney Burke, one of the members of the High Pointers Club, who was serving as a host at Gerimuth Hill, explained that the Bissettes and I weren't the first visitors to be surprised at the ease with which one can reach the state's summit, 812 feet above sea level.
I don't know what people expected when they came back here, but sometimes they would actually put on full backpacks and hiking sticks and hiking boots, and they thought it was going to be quite a trek to get up here to this rock. And obviously they'd become disappointed after about a 2-minute walk in the woods. So they would stand on that rock and do just the big hero, Superman kind of shot and, make kind of a joke about the whole thing. And a couple of people actually went back and would get their ice axes and then come back and get a summit shot that way.
Actually, the ascent of Gerimuth Hill has not always been comically simple. Until just a few months ago, the people who owned the property abutting Route 101 and extending into the woods, property those who seek the highest point in Rhode Island must cross, were hostile to the idea. Officials in the High Pointers Club, a group of people who delight in climbing to the highest points in various states, had to limit their Rhode Island adventures to a few designated holiday weekends. Gene Trousdale, visiting Gerimuth Hill from Norman, Oklahoma, is a high-pointing veteran of those bad old days.
Oh, yes. It was very difficult. People got chased. People got hollered at. People got shot at. It was not...
Got shot at?
Well, I don't think they were high pointers, and I don't really know the whole story, but yeah.
Just a couple of months ago, Jeff and Debbie Mosley bought the property. They have maintained an open trail policy on weekends, and last weekend they were out in the woods with a dozen or so members of the High Pointers Club improving the trail. As far as High Pointer Gene Trousdale is concerned, the Mosleys are a blessing.
They came up to our convention the other night, and they got quite a round of applause and a standing ovation because everybody knows how difficult this has been. In fact, for a long time, it counted if you stopped on the highway out in front of the house because it couldn't get in here.
Gene Trousdale has climbed to the high points of 42 states. A cranky knee will probably prevent her from reaching a 43rd, but on Monday, accompanied by her golden retriever Penny, she participated enthusiastically in grooming the trail up Gerimuth Hill and proudly showed me a tattoo on her leg of the High Pointers logo. Trousdale also serves as the club's marketeer.
They call me Mother Merc because the name of my store is the High Pointers Mercantile. We sell T-shirts and sweatshirts and books and hiking books and other cool stuff.
And, of course, once you've accomplished a certain number of high points, you get your plaques and your pins and all the rest. That all come from you as well?
That's right, yeah. I handle the five-point patches and pins for 25, 30, 40, 48, and the big one for 50. And then also 50 completers. Their pin is free, but if they want to order a plaque, it's a beautiful plaque indicating they've got 50 high points.
According to club records, only about 140 of the 3,000 high pointers have reached the highest point in all 50 states, which requires summiting Alaska's Mount McKinley and Mount Rainier in Washington State, among other challenges. John Mitchler, a co-director of the club who lives in Golden, Colorado, has earned his plaque. I couldn't help but ask him if ascending the lump alongside Highway 101 in Rhode Island didn't feel a little silly after the climbs he'd made in Alaska and elsewhere.
Actually, sometimes it's just the opposite. It's more fun. It's you get and you see an easy one, and it's sort of a relief. Instead of a large Western mountain or a difficult New England hike, it's easy, and you actually enjoy the high point rather than the hiking.
John's wife, Kathy, was with him in Rhode Island. Though she has only climbed to the tops of 5 states, she has been to the highest points in every county in Florida and Vermont. She says the attraction is less the feeling of accomplishment than the opportunity to discover something wherever she goes. On a recent business trip, she sought out the highest point in Brooklyn, New York.
It's actually on a cemetery, a famous cemetery that, heavens, I would never think to go to. I think you get used to just always thinking about high pointing, and you tend to be more active, you know, but it's a learning experience. A lot of education in all of this.
Education and surprises, too, some of which reveal the humor to which high pointers are partial. For example, imagine, if you will, the most dangerous journey to a high point. Would it be one in which the weather at the top of a mountain might suddenly plunge 50 degrees, one known for punishing winds or treacherously slippery rocks? Not according to Gary White of Double Springs, Alabama, whose first high point was in the state he now calls home.
Mount Cheeha.
Mount Cheeha.
That's a big mountain,
yeah,
compared to this one.
Well, it's
at 2,407 feet above sea level, Mount Cheeha is bigger than Gerimuth Hill. But Gary White sheepishly admits that reaching Alabama's high point requires no hiking at all. You can drive to the top of it, and the marker's right behind the Welcome Center. White has 43 high points to his credit, and he has climbed in Washington and Wyoming. But the most dangerous high point, he says it's no contest.
Well, most people think the most dangerous high point is probably Delaware, because the fact that it's at the middle of a street intersection.
So you hike in there, you got to be watching what you're doing.
Watch
semi might come by.
Right, a lot bigger than a high pointer running over you.
Actually, high pointers are unlikely to run over anybody. Those gathered in Rhode Island following their convention in New Hampshire last weekend didn't seem especially interested in competition. Each happily acknowledged the accomplishments of the others. All of them celebrated the fact that the trail up Gerimuth Hill was open on weekends rather than closed almost all the time. Everybody seemed utterly happy cutting brush, raking stones on the path, or working to mount a mailbox beside the rock at the top of Rhode Island.
Kenny, you ready to go work? Come on. Okay.
It was hard to ignore the email.
We are getting together on Saturday at 6 p.m. in Boston to play bowling.
It read,
there'll be a chance for exchange and a question and answer period also for those who have questions. Raelian philosophy will replace all major religions in this third millennium.
Raelians, for those who don't know, are followers of the French journalist Claude Vaurilon, a.k.a. Raël. Their religion holds that life on Earth was created by extraterrestrials called the Elohim. Perhaps at this moment you're thinking what only a game Sean Cole was thinking when he received the email. That's absurd. They can't be serious. I mean, really? Bowling? Oh, but they were serious. And last summer, Sean Cole came back with this story.
I walked into Boston Bowl, your standard bowling alley arcade a few minutes from downtown, knowing a thing or two about the Raelians. I knew that one of their missions was to create an embassy on Earth for the Elohim, so that we might reunite with our creators. I knew that a Raelian scientist had claimed to have generated the world's first human clone in 2002. I knew that they had chapters all over the world, that they'd only been in Massachusetts for a couple of years, and I knew what the head of the Massachusetts chapter, Mehran Sam, looked like, because I'd seen him on TV.
Hey, how are you doing? Good to see you.
What I hadn't known was that the Raelians bowled.
We're down-to-earth guys. We are people like everybody else. As I said, we are from all walks of life. We have our own full-time jobs, and we are active members of the society, and we like to have fun, and we do all the normal things that other people do, too.
Mehran is from Iran. He's a biologist with a PhD from the University of Toronto. He wasn't wearing a spacesuit, had regular clothes, regular hair. In fact, the only way you would have known he was a Raelian was by the silver medallion around his neck. a Star of David with a whirlpool in the middle.
This symbol is the symbol of infinity, is the symbol of Elohim. You can see it in India, you can see it in South America, you can see it in so many different cultures that did not have any interaction with each other because it's come from them, from our scientific creators, the Elohim.
Two other fairly normal-looking children of the Elohim showed up around the same time I did, a married couple named Cassio and Albi. Mehran asked me not to interview them, or anyone else at the event that night except him. So we sat, waiting for the rest of the uninterviewable bowling Raelians to arrive. They did not. I kept the conversation with Mehran going as best I could while we were waiting, but it wasn't easy. I mean, what do you ask the head of the Massachusetts Raelian movement in this situation?
So do you prefer candle pin or ten pin bowling?
I play both. I guess the candle maybe. It doesn't really matter. They're both fun. As long as you have fun, that's the main thing.
This is actually a key precept in Raelian thinking. That people are born to experience pleasure, and that you can't bring happiness to others if you're not happy yourself. To this end, the prophet Rael espouses sexual permissiveness, sensual meditation, nudity, and sports.
We say that playing games is a lot of fun, and it's important that we do play games. The people who are very serious all the time and they take everything so seriously, they are also not healthy. They don't have the...
Mehran explained a lot about Raelian philosophy that night, which is surprisingly similar to more mainstream religions. Elohim, for example, is a Hebrew word, but Mehran said it was mistranslated in the Bible to mean God. It really means those who came from the sky, he said, i.e. outer space.
And it was Elohim who sent the prophets, like Jesus, Moses, Buddha, Muhammad, all these prophets were sent by them to guide humanity to the age of science and technology we are now in.
But when we bombed Hiroshima 60 years ago this month, the Elohim realized that we had now advanced to the point where we could destroy ourselves and that they'd better send another prophet down here. So in December 1945, Rael was conceived.
Rael's mother is a human being from Earth, but his father is Yahweh, who is the president of the Elohim.
If this part sounds familiar, it's because, according to the story, the Virgin Mary was also impregnated by the Elohim 2,000 years ago.
So Rael is, in fact, the brother of Jesus.
I never thought I'd be having this conversation in a bowling alley.
It's great, huh? Life is full of surprises.
And it was about to get fuller. When it was clear that no one else was coming, Mehran, Cassio, and Albi asked me to bowl with them. I told them I hadn't planned on it, that I should probably just watch, but they insisted. There's only three of us, they said, and we need a fourth. Of course, when we got to our assigned lane, we learned that each player's score is tabulated individually on a computer console. They didn't need a fourth player at all. But it was too late. I already had my funny shoes on.
So, Mehran's winning so far.
Oh, now it's a religious thing.
This is Albi. As it turns out, he's not a Raelian at all, just a lapsed Catholic who's married to one. He's also a pretty good play-by-play announcer, offering to call the game whenever it was my turn.
He's confronting the lane. He's shooting. Got a ball.
No, I'm embarrassing myself.
That's beautiful.
No, it's not beautiful at all.
It is, Joe. It's fine.
His wife, Cassio, was doing a lot better than me at first, too.
Nice, nice strike! Watch this!
Oh my God! Cassio downs eight pins on her second turn.
Though later, she accidentally threw herself onto the floor, which isn't nearly as embarrassing as my ripping off half my thumbnail in one of the smooth, edgeless finger holes. I'm not sure what I was expecting. People with quilted shoulder pads psychically manipulating the ball as it levitated 3 inches off the parquet floor. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it was nothing this ordinary. I'm sure everyone around us figured we were just another group of friends having fun on a Saturday night. If the Raelians really want people to believe that they're just like everybody else, they've hit upon a great way to do it. And they seem to know that. Believe it or not, when Mehran first contacted the Raelians, back when he was a graduate student in Toronto, they invited him to go bowling.
The first time that I called them, they said, okay, we are going bowling like in next week. So me and my friend, we went there in that bowling alley in Toronto. There were like four or five other Raelians. They all had this symbol on their neck. And we met them and we saw they're very normal people. They're happy, they're laughing, they're joking around. And I said, these are great. And they invited me to their next lecture. And from then on, I've been part of the movement and I decided to help Rael.
Were they good bowlers?
Not really. We are just average. Some of us are good, but I'm average, if not below.
I don't know if modesty is a typically Raelian trait, but Mehran has it in spades. After pulling away from the pack early on, nothing about his game fell under the definition of average.
Oh, look at him now. Oh,
oh my God. Oh! Strike for Mehran. Very good.
Thank you.
Especially not compared to me.
We're back at Candle Pins Live for Cash, and here's Sean. He's setting it up. He's throwing it backwards.
Careful back here.
He shoots again. It's a blistering gutter ball.
In the end, Mehran whipped everyone, earning 96 points compared to Albie's 79 and my 69. Cassio was last at 54. Still, if the point of the evening was to have fun, we definitely did. The prophet Rael would have been proud. Except that bowling isn't really his sport of choice. Before learning, he'd been conceived by extraterrestrials in order to deliver their message to humanity. He had dreamed of becoming a Formula One racing champion. For Only a Game, I'm Sean Cole in Boston.
Oh, there she goes. That's going to be
yes.
a strike.
Nice!
Almost, almost.
That was good.
Nine pins down. Okay.
After this piece aired, Sean Cole found out that Mehran Sam was nominated to Level 5 Bishop Guide, which apparently is a good thing.
Oh, I'm a Raelian. I was born a Raelian. I'm a Raelian on planet. Oh, I'm a Raelian. I was born a Raelian. I'm a Raelian on planet. I met the prophet at the seminar. He's the hero of our day. It takes love to suffer ignorance and smile. Be yourself, no matter what they say.
Oh, I'm a Raelian. I was born a Raelian. I'm a Raelian on planet Earth.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Greg Fazio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to browse Only a Game's show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from a Raelian bowling enthusiast.
We shall strike planet Earth! We shall spare no one!
Or was that a Raelian stand-up comic? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year.
To know the concept of infinity, all things connected in this world, learning the value and the meaning of self-worth. Be yourself, no matter what they say. Be yourself, no matter what they
say. Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.